Hello and welcome to the Smart Beauty Podcast. I'm your host, Viola Levy, beauty journalist and founder of copy-led branding agency, Smart Beauty Creative. We're here to create your brand voice and craft the story behind it. Today, my guest is the extraordinary and wonderful Rhea Cartwright, a powerhouse in the beauty industry, and my former editor, whose career has redefined what is possible in the beauty space. From starting on the shop floor during her university days, to becoming the first and only black woman to be head of beauty buying in the UK at the iconic Liberty London, Rhea's journey is nothing short of groundbreaking. Along the way, she's worn many hats, including sales and training roles, becoming a qualified facialist, as well as working as a brand consultant. During lockdown, she turned her hand to beauty journalism, writing for Vogue, Refinery, and Marie Claire, among others. She then became beauty editor for The Stack World. Fun fact, she was also my editor during that time. After being headhunted on Instagram by Liberty buying director Sarah Coonan, Rhea spent 18 months at Liberty, where she left her mark as a trailblazing buyer. Now she's making exciting forays into the world of venture capitalism, proving once again that her vision knows no bounds. This is a two-part conversation, and in the first half, we unpack the power of building a personal brand to accelerate your career, the art of being disruptive to bring about meaningful change, and Rhea's own insights from her time as a beauty buyer, and what it meant to be the first to challenge the status quo and push back without being stereotyped as quote-unquote the angry black woman. We also discuss how brands are missing the mark when marketing to millennials, something both Rhea and I, as card-carrying members of this generation, feel very strongly about. I really enjoyed this chat and hope you do too. Here's part one of our conversation. So thank you so much for joining me today, Rhea. It's a delight to have you on the show. Firstly, can you talk about your career journey and what led you to beauty buying?
Those are probably honestly two like very different questions, because my career journey unintentionally led me to buying, because I didn't I guess for reference, I was head of beauty buying at Liberty. I was the first and only black head of beauty buying for a luxury retailer in the UK. I would hazard a guess that it is a larger region than that, and I would even hazard a guess that actually a head of beauty buying probably for a retailer full stop, but it's black. Which I think is just a very important thing to distinguish. My career journey, as you know very well, has been the smorgasbord of beauty. So I started off, honestly, like on the shop floor when I was in my very, very early 20s and I was still at uni. And then I got into kind of sales and training roles for brands. So I worked for Oskia, Chantecaille, The Organic Pharmacy. Then I was head of ops for a skin clinic, like a facial clinic, Mr. Independent, like one clinic brand. And also just prior to that, bizarrely, did a facial qualification course. And I started consulting very early on. I met someone based in the US who is known as a brand agent. So her role is to kind of do retailer acquisition for brands. She will help on their production, manufacturing, supply chain. She does everything. She's literally like an agent for brands. She's based in LA. And I met her by chance when I was on that specific day. I was actually in Harvey Nichols whilst working for Organic Pharmacy. And I could tell she wasn't a customer because of the question she asked. Like, it's like when you're a beauty industry insider and you go to a store, you browse and peruse very differently as to when you genuinely need something. So I was like, she is not a customer. So we were just talking and I was just being like giving a lot of flair in my answers. I was like, maybe she'll just hire me. And then she was like, anyway, here's my card, email me. And I was like, great. So because of her, I got into consulting really early and essentially making a lot of US brands relevant for the UK market. So again, maybe things on the brand side, copy, even things like MPD, like what is the US doing, or is, I don't know, like an Indian brand doing that maybe isn't translating well for a Western market.
Sounds fascinating. Then, I'd love to get into that.
Yeah, it was really, yes, it was interesting. And then during, honestly, the first, you know, the first wave of lockdowns in 2020, I started to take, I guess, the beauty journalism side a bit more seriously, because in 2019, the amazing Jacqueline Kilakita, now beauty director, very recently, big, I love Jackie, so I just want to shout out Jackie, at Refinery29, she approached me to write, and I was like, yeah, sure, like, why not? I didn't really think much of it. And, you know, that basically opened the door for me to then write for a whole host of fantastic publications. I should name drop them because I should. That's what I'm here for, I guess. So I wrote for Vogue, yeah, Net-a-Porter, the Zoe Report. I wrote a lot for the US, actually, for the Zoe Report. Marie Claire, Dazed, Beauty. There'll be more, but I can't remember who they are. And then because of that, then led me to be the beauty director at the Stack World, which is obviously where I guess you and I first properly met. And you wrote some amazing, like, award nominated pieces for us at the Stack.
You were the best editor, honestly. It was so lovely working with you, and
it wasn't hard. It wasn't, you know, it was just, it was, I remember the day that I told the team that, you know, we're kind of running this piece, and they're like, how to smell expensive, like, what does that even mean? And there was actually quite a lot of pushback, and I was like, trust me, I know it's gonna do really well. And the views that we got on that piece were huge. For like a good 3-4 weeks, it was the number one read piece. So I was like, get in.
Oh my gosh,
in.
It's so lovely. And now it's a huge thing, it was just,
And it's funny as well, because I guess, like, you know, when you're writing, you never really find out those details very often. So I was like, probably never shared that with you even. Anyway, so all of that kind of, all these kind of weird and wonderful threads. And then I was literally sent a DM by Sarah Coonan, who is the current managing director of Liberty. And she sent me, and also, by the way, all of my jobs come from DMs. Even the Stack, Sharmadine sent me a DM. Sarah Coonan sent me a DM, and she was like, I've got this role. I've interviewed like everybody, because it's, you know, it was, they'd been trying to hire like for 3 months. And I want someone that's very different background. She was like very outspoken, very opinionated. She was like, are you up for it? And I was like, well, if that's what you want, kind of sounds like me. And then I was on a holiday at the time. And then we, when I got back, we met up, and it was kind of, it was like instant kind of soul yes from me. And then, yeah, we had a fabulous, fun, wild 18 months of kind of being the steward. You know, it's 150 years next year that Liberty has been around for. It's got such an iconic heritage brand. So of course the store is going to outlive anybody that works there, but to be the steward for such an important time and do so many great projects is something that I'm very proud of.
And I think it's interesting when you say like all of the roles came through DMs, because I think it says a lot about the power of building a personal brand, especially on social media. Would you agree?
100%. I, you know, as well, I think there are people that do it intentionally and people that don't. Unfortunately, I wish I could say that it was intentional for me, and it absolutely isn't. I'm not that organized, and I'm quite chaotic in my personal life. But I think that what my values and what I stand for, I'm so strong in that. And people are often quite shocked when they meet me in real life. They're like, oh, you're exactly how you come across, whether it's a written piece or, you know, I don't know, an Instagram story. And I'm like, yeah, because there's only one me. I can't give different versions. And I think when you have very clear boundaries, but also very clear vision for what, to me, beauty not should look and feel like, everybody should have their own values, but in terms of what I believe brands should be doing, retailers should be doing, even I guess publications should be doing, then it's very easy if somebody else shares those values for you to be in alignment. I think whereas people that are a bit more either vague or on the fence about things, it's hard until of course you actually properly meet them to understand what their perspective is. I've, you know, kind of rightly or wrongly always been quite explicit with what my perspectives are, and it has served me, you know, very well so far. So I think I'll continue to do that. But it's mind-boggling to me how many clients come via DM. And I, you know, it's like big, you know, you don't become like a beauty director or a head of beauty buying typically from from Instagram. So
no.
Yeah, I'm very grateful.
Amazing.
I've not applied for a job in a really long time.
No.
Which again, I guess if you're freelance, quite often that is the case. But I guess because I have been in-house, I was at Liberty for 18 months. I was at the Stack for probably just under 2 years. And I think as well, like I really enjoy this, I guess now it's called like a portfolio career, but I like going somewhere, having a bit of a project and then being like, okay, I'm done now. This is fun, but I'm on to the next thing. Cause I get bored quite easily. And I get frustrated very easily as well, which probably isn't helpful. But so it means that probably my perfect corporate company fit, I've not found yet. Maybe I will find it and maybe I will just continue what I'm doing. And again, I quite like that. And it also means that you get to meet such a spectrum of people. Like when I think about the people that I know and my network, it's so rich and I'm so glad. And it means that I can lean on people and also people can lean on me and they can get intros and, you know, it works, you know, so many different ways. So I kind of enjoy this patchwork career that I'm building for myself.
I think it pays to be slightly disruptive if you're building a brand for yourself, wouldn't you say? Because there's, you know, there's such a monoculture, with especially within our industry. I mean, it's slowly starting to change, but I like to think I'm fairly outspoken as well and just call it like I see it. And I feel like, yeah, there's the more of that, the better, I think, because otherwise it just becomes so stagnant, doesn't it? And people
100%.
Kind of accept norms that shouldn't be the norm.
It's as well, like, beauty is so, I feel like the sheer nature of a beauty standard is to have this very homogenous and also monotonous idea of what beauty should look like, number one, on a very surface level, but also feel like, talk like, behave like. And maybe it sounds kind of a bit deep, but it is deep. Like we either create products or create words or create worlds in which consumers come to shop and buy and then use products in their own bathroom. And if the people pulling all the levers, whether it's in publications or in retail or in brand building, look and think and feel and dress the same, from the same backgrounds, the same socioeconomic conditions, then nothing changes. And quite frankly, you know, women, and it is for the most part women that are in those positions, that do look and feel and dress and spend and shop the same way, have been the ones in power. That's not to discredit where some, you know, people can't help where they're from. I'm not saying, oh well, you know.
No, but it's more Emily about the like infrastructure, isn't it, and the kind of the
exactly
fact
exactly, you know, even within, let's, you know, beauty journalism, the majority of beauty directors are from white privileged backgrounds. The majority of, and therefore, you know, to get into journalism, if you don't have a buffer, at least, because who can afford to do an unpaid internship in London? You know, not many people.
No, I couldn't. No.
No, absolutely not. And then, you know, in buying, you know, you think you've got, we're so lucky in the UK. We've got so many fantastic retailers to shop. You know, we've got great places to we're very spoiled, especially in London. We've got great department stores, great luxury department stores, great niche stores. You know, we've got, again, just a plethora of places to explore beauty. But, you know, if every buying team has maybe got, you know, a team of between 6 to 15, the majority are white, I can guarantee that a majority will probably be blonde, and a large proportion of them are called Emily. At one point in Liberty, at Liberty rather, pre me, there were two beauty buyers, both called Emily, on the team at the same time. Like Space NK, they've got Emily Beauty Buyer. Like it's almost like a joke. Like, okay, if your name is either Emily or Hannah, you're probably a beauty buyer. And again, it that dictates the products that are on the shelves, because actually, if there is a product for textured hair, whether it's, you know, I mean, to be fair, like yours and my hair texture isn't, our natural hair texture isn't massively dissimilar. If everybody's got, you know, straight blonde hair, then how can they try a product that's been made for 3B to 4C hair? They categorically can't. So it really dictates and shapes the products that customers can ultimately get. And if therefore brands from people of color, whether they're designed for people of color or not, means that they don't get access. And it becomes this really, again, the beauty product side of the business also becomes very homogenous, and it comes from the same type of people.
Yeah. It's a domino effect, isn't it?
It affects so many things. So I don't remember what the question was, but yes, being disruptive. Yes, that's it. Being disruptive, it works, because the only way to create change in an industry that, despite what people say, the industry at the top doesn't want change, because it will threaten the status quo. It will threaten the big beasts of beauty and the big groups. The only way to change that is to disrupt. And that is a hill that I will die on.
But also there's that kind of emotional labor that you have to do, kind of being the first. It's incredible what you've done, but it's also, I imagine, just a huge burden as well. I mean, just from like a class perspective, I went to work on this magazine as a freelancer, and I felt so out of place. And it was this kind of posh girl cohort. And I remember just running out at one point and just crying because I just felt so intimidated. And yeah, obviously that was very young back then, and I couldn't give a shit now, but it's that thing of having to be the first to do everything. I mean, did you find that in your career, and when you were the only black person in the room, I'm sure, in a lot of scenarios?
How did you in 99% of the scenarios? It's twofold. I think the first one is, by being the only one, there is a sense of pressure, because whether somebody else is putting the pressure on you or not, you ultimately know that you are representing your community. And therefore, you know, if I'm a representative of my community, then surely I would do everything in my power to further it or to benefit it in some way. And the unfortunate reality is that I remember the first time I had to exit, I had to get rid of some brands at Liberty, and they were black owned brands. And it was very, very, very difficult, extremely difficult. I was going to use the word traumatic, but I can't say traumatic, but it was
up there.
It was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do. And the reason those brands had to be cut in the first place was because, as I said, the beauty buying team at the time were all white, and it was post George Floyd's murder in 2020, and the organization, like many others, has said, you know, we commit to onboarding X% of black owned brands over the next 12 months. So they onboarded brands that weren't the right fit for the Liberty customer. Great brands that absolutely would, and I'm sure are, thriving elsewhere. But you can't expect to put a brand, or any brand, by the way, whether it's, you know, regardless of the ethnicity of the founder, to put a brand on a shelf and not have a kind of a diligent marketing plan behind it. Because without marketing, there are no sales. That's why sales and marketing teams should sit so closely together. So it was, it was really hard. The other side of things, like you said, is that lack of representation. I mean, as a beauty buyer, you know, you have to have so many meetings with brands, of which sometimes there might be, you know, three of us from the buying team in a meeting with maybe 7 to 8 brand representatives. So you might have the general manager or the MD with their marketing director, some assistants, whatever, whoever it is. I mean, truly 99.9% of the time, I was the only, not just black, but person of color, full stop. So it reveals that it's, and there are some examples of seeing marketing initiatives from brands that were so, I would use the word distasteful, that you could tell that there was nobody that had kind of sense checked it. And again, mistakes happen, right? People are human. I don't think anybody's thinking, oh, well, people can't slip up. There are times when we all will make mistakes, whether it's with race or with, you know, gender or, you know, pronouns, anything. Like, nobody is perfect.
No.
But the things that I've never said this publicly, but I'll say it here. I was in a meeting with Kiehl's, And you know how in marketing, when there's NPD, so new product development, they'll often have like a tiered system. So it could be kind of bronze, silver, or gold launch, or it could be stars. You know, 3-star is the goal. That's their kind of the product that they're putting, that they expect to have the most amount of growth. Whereas a 1-star is, you know, we're launching it, but we don't expect it's going to be like a huge mix of business.
Yeah.
So rather than have stars, Kiehl's decided to use K's. So you'd had 1K for a small launch.
Gosh.
2Ks or a KKK for a launch that they believed would have been a huge commercial hit. So we're in this meeting and we had it virtually, thank God, because I would have said the same thing either way. I'm seeing probably on my side, four Liberty team members, and again, 7 to 8 of them. And I'm like, God, it would have been great if you'd used a different tiering system, wouldn't it? Almost jokingly. And they were like, what? And I was like, you know, KKK probably isn't the best kind of to indicate what you believe will be your number one best-selling product of next year or whatever. And they were like, oh, we got off the meeting, and within 5 minutes, he's now left now, but the general manager of Kiehl's UK, that's a huge job, sent me a personal email apologizing. And it's things like that I do not expect to see in 2024. Frankly, I don't expect to see them full stop outside of the time when those people and those weirdos were even existing prominently. But it's like, it's the oversight that happens when you don't have diversity in teams or people that have friends from diverse backgrounds.
For sure. I mean, everyone's got their blind spots, and it's not like people are doing things intentionally. But like, as you say, if you don't have people who are the decision makers, who are representative of, you know, various different communities, then those things are going to crop up. What were the kind of, were there any other kind of moments like that you felt were kind of up there with?
100%. So I remember there was there was a skincare brand, and beautiful brand, without what kind of spa, a luxury kind of a brand with a spa heritage, we'll call it that. And I remember all of their imagery at the time on marketing and social, again, was very white blonde. And I remember the first meeting I had with them, I was like, I really love your brand. I've used your brand for probably over 10 years, but like, you've got to do something about your representation and your marketing. You know, within 6-7 months time, they'd done a really great campaign with Hannah Hillier, who's a UK-based photographer and creative director. She's worked with like Rode, Ilya, you name it, Hannah's worked with them. She is amazing, and she's also divine. And as soon as I saw the work, I knew it was hers because it had her kind of look and feel. I've seen hair brushes and presentations. Oh, I mean, we'd get sent so many decks of things we'd never touch. But, you know, I remember seeing a deck from a celebrity hairdresser, a very well-known celebrity hairdresser, is launching a brand, probably already is launched somewhere. And, you know, one of the slides was like their famous clients. Again, they all had the same hair texture. They were all white, all had the same hair texture.
Yeah.
And I was like, so why truly would we take your brand if it only answers to one type of customer? It doesn't make sense, because frankly, even within, you know, people, white people, you have different hair textures. So it just made literally no sense. And what I would often say to brands, you know, again, actually, I can think of, you know, the kind of the French heritage brands,
worst
they
offenders.
Are, yeah, I was about to say, they're notoriously quite often the worst. And again, they would then do things like, oh, we've done a collaboration with some black artists. Again, it's better than nothing. Like, I'm not saying for sure that's not the right thing to do. For me, that's not the progress that I'd like to see, but it's a step. The hard thing is, like, you know, when you're always the mouthpiece, and I would say to them, quite frankly, no one else is going to tell you. Like, my Harrods equivalent, my Selfridges equivalent, my Space and Clay equivalent, whatever, is never going to tell you these things, because they're not going to see them. And if they, and in the event that they do see them, they're not going to say it, because they won't feel like it's their place to. Whereas I feel like it is my place to, because if I don't, you're not going to learn. I didn't care. Like, if I say to a brand, your marketing, your campaign to the shake up because your models all look like one family, like, and it's felt like that for kind of 5 to 10 years, I couldn't care less what they think about me in that immediate, because actually what I want is I want your company to make more money for my store. And I know that if your campaigns are more inclusive, if the language that you use is more inclusive, I'm going to make more money and so are you. And not only that, the customer is going to feel seen and feel heard and feel empowered. And fundamentally for me, that's what it's all about. Everything that I do is I want people to feel seen, heard and empowered. So if I'm not doing that, if I'm not pushing and being disruptive for that reason, then I'm not living in my purpose.
Did you ever receive any pushback when you kind of made those comments? Did people ever get defensive? Or was it
to be
mainly
honest, not really? I mean, also as well, like, I'm so blunt that I've had people ask me, like, are you autistic? which to my knowledge I'm not, but I would never get tested, because if I am, then I am. So like, if there were pushback, I just don't even see it, because I don't care. Like, it's I know that if some of these brands fundamentally have a history of ignoring certain racial demographics. I've had brand founders. I remember one time there was a brand that I actually worked for, and I remember when I finally met the founder, because they weren't based in the UK, I was like, you know, would you ever think about, you know, ever using like darker skin people in your campaigns? And they were like, no, we only really want to use white and Chinese, because those are our biggest markets. And I'm like, cool. And I was like, it's crazy, because you've got, you know, you've got, they did skincare and they did color cosmetics as well. And they had color cosmetics, they had some fantastic foundations that went up to, you know, really deep, beautiful, rich shades. And I'm like, why would that woman ever think that your brand would be good for them and their skin tone if they don't see themselves in your campaign? Like, it's such a miss. I could write a book with the things that, you know, I've experienced. I'm sure, to be honest, that every single other woman of color that works in beauty, especially in luxury beauty, again, whether it's either the publication side, buying, whatever, would say the exact same. And the challenge is, I think, that quite often people don't speak up, and I understand why, because you don't really want to be seen as disruptive. There's that, it's a delicate balance between almost like disruptive and the angry black woman. And when you're slapped with certain labels, then you don't want to appear that you're difficult to work with. So again, as my ex-boss, so Sarah Coonan, once told me, she's like, you're really blunt, but you're really charming. And I'm like, great. Like, that's a great place that I'd like to be. And I am. I recognize those in myself. I'm really blunt, but I'm also very personable. I wouldn't call myself charming. That seems like a strange thing to talk about myself. But I enjoy people. I like people. I like connecting with people. And actually, I think that the best thing about building a relationship with someone, anybody, professionally or personally, is that then you can say the difficult things, because it's not saying difficult things to be an asshole. It's saying the difficult things for the progression of the industry, and again, fundamentally for the joy of the customer. For me, that's what it should all be about.
Yeah, because you're trying to help them at the end of the day, like you say, make more money for their brand. So, you know, they should, you know, be grateful for the free consultancy that you're giving them.
I see, that's what a lot of Liberty felt like. And that's what it was almost kind of, when Sarah and I were first talking about it, that's almost what she was saying. She was like, you know, you consult anyway. So imagine that you're consulting, but you now have like 180 brands. That's kind of what it felt like in some cases, because some of those brands, not necessarily in Liberty, but in general, are losing market share at a rapid pace. You know, we've had so many indie beauty brands come and disrupt the industry with, you know, just faster, because they don't have so much red tape around them or kind of antiquated ideas. You know, even something like Elisa Eldred, Westman Hillier, yes, they're big businesses now, but they're still classified as indie beauty by nature of they are independent. They're not tied to a LVMH or a Lauder or a L'Oreal. And, you know, I think that what those brands are able to do, the pace at which they're able to launch products, and I guess just the connection with the customer, is something that it's very challenging for a heritage legacy brand to do that, because A, well, the founders are dead. So how do you kind of, you know, having a strong founder makes it a lot easier to have this notion of community. And secondly, it's like, okay, well, actually, what are the values of a legacy brand if they've never been spoken about or really kind of hammered down on before, those values, to suddenly invent them from nowhere is quite hard to do that in a really authentic way. I'm sure some brands are, but it's just there are a lot of brands out there that need a lot of help. And I always say, you know, I love working either really at the kind of very early like venture stage, because you can make so much impact, or brands that have been around for, you know, years and years and years, that if they don't do something soon, won't exist in 5 to 10 years. That's my kind of happy place.
There are a lot of brands, like you say, that just need, you know, that need to keep up with the new sort of more like indie players on the market that are more switched on and more dynamic. I mean, have you seen the sort of, what are the biggest kind of changes in beauty retail, would you say, have been since lockdown? I mean, I feel there's that huge kind of push towards authenticity, like brands expected to be seen to stand for something now. It's no good just kind of saying, oh, we care about everyone and it's all sort of bland and generic, but no, what actually are your values? What do you stand for? Would you agree that that's the case with a lot of brands we see today?
You know what it is? I don't know if I think that it's more so than pre-pandemic. I just think that people are a bit braver now. So I think, you know, if I think about even, let's say, like The Body Shop, you know, and then Anita Roddick, and, you know, what was that, 1976 or 75 or 76? That was a brand that had, you know, huge values and was very kind of progressive, of course, with what she did, but was also very explicit. And that was what, you know, 50 years ago. So I don't think that brands are more louder with their values. I just think they're a bit braver with it. I think as well, I think, again, the shift probably is that we've got so many brands now that are, that have a founder that's very forward facing. Whereas, you know, again, perhaps historically you had a brand, but you might not know who the founder is as much. Whereas, again, I guess, frankly, the concept of a personal brand on social media didn't exist, you know, 10 years ago. So I think that now, you know, yes, the not only does the brand itself have a platform, but the founder typically has a platform as well. And I guess, you know, we're seeing that, you know, quite honestly, a brand Instagram is so boring. Like, there are very, very few brands. If I follow any brand, it's either because it's a kind of a close friend of mine or someone that I know, or they're doing something interesting. And that's probably less than 10, because most brand Instagrams are so bloody boring. It's just like, I don't need to see a picture. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, exactly. Whereas brand founders, I follow lots of founders and therefore would buy their product and love their brand, because that to me is more interesting. Like, as a narrative, yeah, frankly, I'm more interested in what a successful entrepreneur is doing and how they're navigating their day whilst also showing us product, versus an Instagram page that's just showing me product all day, every day. Like, I know how to use a cleanser. Thanks very much. You know what I'm saying? Like, I want to know, like, yes, you've launched a new cleanser, but also show me those new shoes that you've bought. And I think that for a lot of, for me as well, when I think about how brands, I say this a lot, by the way, I really feel that brands, not just beauty, I think all brands don't know how to market anymore to millennial women. I think, you know, I think people have forgotten that millennial women now are between the ages of what, 40 to 28 to 40, roughly. And everybody is so hyper fixated on Gen Z, and or the maturer customer, Who I think the maturer customer has so much spending power and has been historically neglected because it's always that thing of, well, growing old is disgraceful, so we're not going to speak to you anyway, which is just, yeah, like, how dare you get older?
You put out to pasture.
Exactly. And I feel like brands are, you know, a brand like Glossier got it right when Glossier launched. But I think even those brands that at the kind of, you know, the height of millennial pink and when we were still young, frankly, I think brands did a great job. I don't think brands have done a very good job of going on the journey with us, because actually, you know, when I was 22 to 23 and there was less choice, maybe it was a bit easier, but now that's demographic, you know, people are getting married and maybe they're on their first divorces now. Like there's gone through this cycle. And we are also a generation that, you know, we grew up with Facebook and Instagram. So whilst TikTok is for sure not the most native platform for our age, I just think that to speak to us, we're so probably simultaneously overwhelmed and underwhelmed with the state of social media because we grew up with it. You know, I remember being 16 and having Facebook, and as soon as, and then having it, you know, into my very early 20s, 21, 22, as soon as my mum got on it, I very swiftly got off because I was like, this is like a place for old people now, obviously. Yeah. And then around that same age, 20, 21, went on to Instagram, which again, then my mum probably didn't have until, you know, it's that the youth always are the early adopters, and then older people, older generations jump on it afterwards. So it's kind of like, well, if back in the day people would use, you know, Facebook groups, and again, the brands that have strong communities, and I think about brands like Trini London, Skin Rocks, also by Caroline Hirons, Dr. Sam Bunting, all three of them have the most thriving Facebook groups you have ever seen. Like, it's they've built a community in which the founders themselves don't have to be active. It's just the brand advocates doing all the talk and commenting. It's amazing. And then again, of course, again, back to millennials and Instagram, we were the early adopters of it. So this whole kind of perfect life and this perfect aesthetic, and when then I guess influencers would then start to do brand deals. And obviously now it's like almost like the anti-perfect. Let's do a photo dump to kind of look normal with an ad sprinkled in. It's like we're all just quite tired of seeing the same shit every day.
Yeah.
So I think for a brand now to market to a millennial, it's kind of hard. It's like, what are you going to show me that's new? How are you going to speak to me in a new way that is really going to capture me?
Join me for part two of my chat with Rhea next week. I hope you enjoyed that episode. All links will be in the show notes, and feel free to visit smartbeautycreative.com or visit us over on Instagram to find out more about what we do. And if you enjoyed listening, please don't forget to rate and review Smart Beauty on iTunes, as it helps people find us. See you next time.